Hello and welcome back to Conversations with Claire. Today's episode is one in which I feel like the standard today's thing would be like, oh, trigger warning, but I don't feel like we're going to do that. So I have a guest today that I'm really excited to dive into a topic that is very sensitive and very personal. And I'm really stoked that she's willing to have this conversation. So my guest is Rochelle Moses. She is a PhD student. She is a researcher, educator, writer, advocate, and consultant. And she's a BJJ baddie. I was like, when she got here, I was like, what belt are you again? And then I was like, I don't even care. That's not how I'm introducing you anyway. but that's how we met. So we met on the mat rolling with one another and quickly realized that we loved rolling together. So anyway, hello. Thank you for being here.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I was trying to think on the way here when that was, because it was right when you started.
Yep.
And I couldn't think, I know it was like in the fall, but I don't remember what month it was.
It was right after the sheepdog response course. And I think that was in September or October of last year. And then immediately following that is when I started finally coming across the street from where I work and actually getting into classes with y'all.
Yeah. As soon as I rolled with you that first day and like trained with you and drilled with you, I went like on the car ride home, I was talking to Corey, my boyfriend, and I was like, I met this chick, Claire. She's super cool. Her energy is just amazing. She's just bubbly and just excited. And I love everything about it.
Yay. I love. And then we literally wind up partnering together very frequently. And I love that. I'll tell one other story that just that you shared with me about your like half guard situation. Right. And how getting to wiggle out of things. Do you want to tell that one? I feel like you should tell that one.
We can. So I'm a short, stocky female. And
she's strong and she has short legs, okay?
All my power is in my thighs, right? That's all of my strength lives in my legs. And so I'm developing a pretty good half guard game, which is basically where you just pinch your legs around one of your opponent's legs. And I'm not the best at it, obviously, because I still have a lot to learn with it. But it's pretty solid. And a lot of brand new people don't really have the ability to get their leg free. And then Claire
is
comes
it even
in.
Brand new people, like, do people in general, because it's so strong, I wouldn't be surprised if people in general are just like, I'm stuck here.
I mean, once they get some skill and they learn like how to get out of it or how to move, then I mean, it's not going to be any match, especially for like bigger guys or more higher level people. Like I'm just a blue belt. That's still a baby in my mind.
Just a blue belt. You're a blue belt. That means something to me.
Yeah. But then Claire comes along and just,
you had to
scoots
teach me.
On by it.
You had to teach me.
Like there short little that. Bursts of movement is really helpful rather than trying to be like one full on powerful leg movement. A little short bursts of movement's a lot helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Cause of course you were doing it to me and I don't even know what's going on. I'm new enough. I'm like, I don't know. I don't even know the name. I don't know what's happening. I just know that there's a lot of tension. I can't, I'm stuck, you know? And so then you chose to share with me, hey, if you want to be able to get out of this, here is what I recommend doing. So you shared that bit of information with me to help me, which was very kind. And I think it really speaks to kind of the culture at 10th Planet for the women's program. It's so cool.
And it's definitely not the only way to get out of it, but that's one of the ways that a former coach of mine shared with me to get out of other people's half guards. So
yeah. And so then I did it and it worked. And then you like went home and were like, okay, I'm glad I taught her because that's cool. And I'm also kind of bummed because now she can get out of it. And I love it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's the us part, but now we're just going to throw the ball back at you and this is going to be all about you for a minute. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So we're going to start with just give me a bit of context, like growing up, what was life like? I know we're going to, and just for reference, guys, we're going to be speaking about domestic violence. And so that's where we're going to head, but let's start a bit earlier.
Okay. So I was raised by a single mom, right? My parents divorced when I was 4 and I never really had a relationship with my dad. It wasn't like court ordered that I go have visits with him, but like the court that messed with their divorce kind of left visiting him up to me because he didn't really fight for custody. So it was kind of left open. Mm-hmm. And so for a little bit, I went to his house like every other weekend, but I wasn't feeling seen there. I felt like I wasn't being treated as his daughter and I just didn't really have fun over there. And as a 4, 5, 6 year old kid, like that's your goal in life is you want to have fun, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And I felt weird. I didn't like it. I wasn't having a good time. I never felt like loved and appreciated by him. I never even really felt seen by him. Mm-hmm. And so finally, like 1 year, I went home and I was like, Mom, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go there anymore. I don't want to see him anymore. He wouldn't call me on my birthday. He wouldn't like ask to see me. He'd be late a lot of times when it was time for him to come pick me up. So I grew up with my mom, and I have one brother on my mom's side, but he's like 15 years older than me. So he kind of was that male role model, male figure in my life.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with them, and it was a very loving household. It was a supportive household, encouraging household. But I was always a really quiet kid. I was my mom's book kid, right? I was the one that like, I'd go play outside, but I'd much rather stay inside and read a book or color or just entertain myself inside.
Okay.
Never really had a lot of friends. I was bullied in elementary school by a couple of different people. I wasn't ever interested in being the center of attention or in the thick of the popular group. And, so I just kind of focused on myself and what I wanted to do. I wanted to have friends, but it's just not something that like ever happened because I was the quieter kid. I was the sit by yourself in the corner of the room kind of kid. And that's not like, oh, feel bad for me. That's just, I was the quiet kid. Mm-hmm. And I had tons of cousins and things. So like I had a very large family that had a lot of get-togethers and things like holidays and whatnot, but I was just never a social butterfly.
Mm-hmm. So your dad wasn't really present in your childhood, but you did have a 15-year older brother, mm-hmm. which was involved. And that is a good age cap. Like that's an adult to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and by then, of course, by the time you're 5, 6, whatever, he's in his 20s. So you did not grow up with an actual father in home, but you didn't grow up in an upbringing where you were witnessing domestic violence.
No, there was never any kind of violence or anything like that in my household. And my brother, he lived at home until he was in his mid-20s. And so like there still was a male role model in my house and mm-hmm. in the house. But there was never any kind of violence, any kind of anything like that in the house. And even my relationship with my dad, like I consider it a big part of why I was introverted and why I was the way I was growing up, but I don't consider it like an abusive relationship or anything like that. It was more so just he just wasn't present.
Yeah. This makes me think of some terminology that I'm learning because we're talking about something that you have a lot more formal education on and just have really spent some time in. And I'm over here doing some studying of emotional health for males and females. Anyway, this makes me think of a term that is new to me about as a child, passive trauma mm-hmm. is what it makes me think of. So like, cause you know, we can acknowledge and identify, like if you witnessed your, you know, mother, father being abused, you are aware of that. If you experienced it personally in some like clearly acute trauma way, someone put their hands on you, someone did something to you, you know, then those are ones that like societally were like, okay, boom, you know, that's that checks. But there's this other more passive variant of trauma that is simply neglect or, you know, dismissiveness. And I think that that gives, as we grow up, like as we start to learn more about this, it gives more of an understanding as to why we behave the way that we behave, or just being able to, oh, okay, I did experience that. Now I have to figure out how to overcome this. But that I do identify with that. Maybe that's why some of these challenges that I experienced, I think it just gives you more agency, the mm-hmm. more tools that you have in your belt, right? And I do want to ask you before we dig a bit deeper into like now the next stages of when you were first introduced to this, but you mentioned I'm a kid who's pretty introverted, relatively so. I enjoy the books more than I enjoy the outdoors. And so here we are. You are, how old are you?
32. 30. 30. Going to turn 32 this year. I'm at that age where you start to forget how old you are.
What month?
July.
Oh, we're like born, I'm about to turn 32 in June. So we're like the same age. Anyway, okay. So here you are in your early 30s now choosing to come on a podcast and expose yourself to other people hearing what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be kind of scary. And this is not the first time you've done this. And so
my curiosity is, why are you choosing to use your voice today in this way whenever maybe you were a bit more quiet growing up? Like, what is the motivator behind your choice to do this now, if that's kind of how you, you know, grew up?
I was actually talking to our mutual friend Maddie about this the other day.
Yeah, shout out Maddie!
And so I'm still a pretty introverted person. I'm still a socially awkward person, and I still have a healthy dose, not a healthy dose actually, but a hefty dose of social anxiety.
Yeah.
And all of that stems from my personal experiences and all that. But the way I think about it that makes the most sense to me is that if I can just help one person in this entire world, and that's a world of 8 billion plus
people. We got
people.
Options.
If I can even help one person better their situation, mm-hmm. then that makes all of the discomfort, all of the awkwardness, all of the difficulty of sharing my personal experiences way worth it.
And do you feel like with reps comes ease? Do you feel like the more that you've chosen to, this is something that my friend Spencer, I went to an event with him last night. He came on my podcast. I've gone on his, Spencer Corson is his name. And he's in like threat security, safety. Mm-hmm. He actually wrote a book called The Safety Trap. And anyway, awesome dude. He and I were talking last night and he like quoted back to me a quote that I used on him, I guess, and who knows where I got it, but just the whole, when you're willing to show up as a human, you give other people the option to now be human as well. And so it's just maybe a matter of like, you chose to, okay, I'm going to step into, cause I can just imagine that it's probably scary, you mm-hmm. know, like the, okay, I'm going to overcome if I truly experience social anxiety, which I think like everybody does at some degree, yeah, varying
a little bit.
Degrees, varying greatly. I definitely am the idiot in the room with like the symbols, like the clapping monkey, you know, like whatever, it's fine. Anyway, look at me, the opposite end of that spectrum, but there's still social anxiety that takes place. I just commend you, because I can imagine if that's something that you've really identified with, and if you've been shy and so on, your willingness to just say, I'm going to like step through that anyway. And the idea that it's motivated by the fact that you just want to help others. It's cool.
And I think another part of it is just, I'm more knowledgeable about my own situation. Like, I've had those years to process it. I'm still processing it. Yeah. I've had the time to think about it and learn about it and fully dive into what happened, how it happened, why it happened. And so it's definitely gotten easier to talk about, like, whenever. So we'll get into it more whenever, but my controlling and abusive relationships happened when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. And that's a really socially formidable chunk of your life. Mm-hmm. And since then, it's gotten way easier to talk about what's happened and what I've been through and where I'm at now and what I'm still dealing with than maybe right when I was fresh out of it. So it definitely has gotten easier the more I talk about it, but also the more I understand it.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So let's go there now. So I was curious if you had experienced it growing up. The answer sounds like no, and it was in your own romantic relationships that you saw the first exposure to this stuff. So just kind of take me there.
Yeah, because that's a great lead-in from my childhood, because it started when I was still a kid, like when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
So I had had one boyfriend for like a month, and it was, you know, your typical first relationship. You're all like cute, lovey-dovey, feel like.
First kiss?
That one, yeah. So that one was fine, but we broke up after a month. Nothing really big or whatever. Nothing really noteworthy necessarily about that. It was the first relationship.
Sure.
Right? First boyfriend.
Yeah.
But then I met this other kid, and we actually met through our parents. So I wasn't a sporty kid, right? But I was on the bowling team.
Get it, girl. Hey, I was the captain of the color guard, okay? I never played a single sport. I threw flags. Okay?
Yeah. So I was on the bowling team, and we would, like, I went bowling like every weekend, and we met there, and it was actually our moms that introduced us to each other, like said, like, you guys should meet. You guys should talk. And instantly had a crush on him. He was what I thought was a super cool kid, super great guy, and super nice and wonderful and everything that you would want in a boyfriend.
How old are you?
This was very shortly before I turned 16. So I was 15.
Got it.
And he was around the same age.
Okay.
And we dated for 5 years. We dated all through that chunk of high school. And I think for me, the first two-ish years of college. And we went to different colleges. And I thought that everything was fine in that relationship. I thought that him doing the things that he did was because he loved me, right? And because he wanted the best for me. And what ended up happening was what I thought was loving and caring behaviors were actually very controlling behaviors, very narcissistic. He was always right. It had to be his way or no way. And that spanned from everything from what I wore to how I looked, how I styled my hair, whether I wore makeup or whether I didn't wear makeup. But he wouldn't ever just say, like, you can't wear that or you have to wear makeup. It's all in like the little manipulative phrasing and wording. So he would say things like, oh, you're so much prettier with your hair straight and long. And so obviously I would want him to think that I was pretty and I would want him to think I was as pretty as possible. So I would straighten my hair and I wouldn't cut it, even though I hated managing long hair when I was younger. He never said you can't wear sweatpants. He would just say things like, girls who wear sweatpants kind of look sloppy, or I think girls who put more effort into their appearance just look better and have a better way about them. So it was just little phrasings of like what he liked.
Yeah.
But it was more so like what I was expected to do.
Would he ever say things like, why do you do that? Or why did you think that that was okay?
No, I was never given the opportunity to explain why I wanted to wear my hair like this, why I wanted to do X, Y, or Z. It was, I think this. Mm. And so the subtle message was, I expect this of you.
Yep.
And
it's just interesting to note, because I will say I can identify in some of this, and maybe either way, I remember a previous relationship that I was in where that was the first one where I was like, something's really wrong here. And things that were said to me as opposed to the, I think this, I'm sure that that took place. But the things that were interesting for me in that one were like, why did you think that sitting that way was okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? And anyway, so different experiences, but continue.
Yeah. And this first relationship with this guy wasn't ever physically abusive. He was just emotionally and psychologically controlling. And he was very, very narcissistic and still is, as far as I can understand. And like, I'm sure some people that are listening are even like, well, that doesn't really sound controlling. He's just saying what he likes. But it's all in the tone that it's said and the arguments that would break out if I would try to buck up against it, if I would try to say my opinion, if I would try to say, well, I'm more comfortable in sweatpants, or I'm just going to the grocery store or whatever. I don't need to put on a full face of makeup. I don't need to do my hair. I don't need to wear jeans and a nice top. I'm just going to get my nails done. And it's not like a social outing. And like I said, we went to two separate colleges. And even there, he was still able to have that control over me. And he would randomly FaceTime me throughout the day, several days a week, every day. And he would play it off as if he was just trying to surprise me, to say hi and see how my day is going and to put a smile on my face and tell me he loved me. But in reality, after I started to see what was really going on, I noticed that it was actually him trying to make sure that I was where I said I was and that I wasn't with people that I didn't tell him I was with. He had to make sure that I was doing what I said I was doing, where I was, where I said I was, and that I was with who I said I was with.
How did you start to identify that the motives behind the behavior were different than what you originally thought or what he was trying to convey? Like, how did you start to pick up on, oh, you're checking in on me because of distrust or whatever?
It wasn't anything gradual. Like, it wasn't like maybe he's doing something different than he says he's doing. So throughout the whole 5 years, both my mom and my brother tried to get me to end it, because they saw right off the bat that it was unhealthy, that he was manipulative, that he was controlling. Mm. And I think one reason, because that happens so frequently, like your support system and your family and your friends usually see the red flags well before you do.
And often are, it sounds like they communicated to you at some point, but are often unwilling to communicate to you for fear of endangering their relationship with you.
Yes. And I mean, it didn't fully hurt our relationships, like with my mom and my brother, but I wouldn't listen to them. I hung up on my brother several times. There wasn't, like, I wasn't willing to hear what they had to say.
Yeah.
And so I just blew it off. I was like, no, he does it because he loves me. He's like that because he loves me. It's not what you think it is. You don't see the real him, but mm-hmm. really they were. I wasn't seeing the real him. And so the big aha moment, I guess. So when I was in college, I worked at the rec center, the campus rec center. And it was, I think like it was just a really bad day between me and him. And we had argued, we weren't on a good, like a good, we just weren't having a good day. And because usually what would happen is if I was put on shift with a guy instead of a girl coworker, that obviously meant that I was cheating with that guy.
Sure.
And I wanted to be on shift with him. I chose to be on shift. I asked to be on shift with him.
Right.
And so I think it was like mid shift, I was just having a breakdown and I was crying uncontrollably at my job that I'm supposed to be interacting with other people, with patrons of the gym. And my boss called me into her office and she said, like, she sat me down and she said, this isn't healthy. Like, this isn't okay. This isn't what a good relationship looks like. Mm. Like, he's doing X, Y, and Z, and this is how you are at work. Like, you're crying uncontrollably. And then I'm thinking I'm going to get fired, right? Because she's my boss telling me, like, this is basically unacceptable.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is at this time, he was studying abroad that semester. So he was in Europe. He wasn't even in the country. But so that kind of made everything an escalated issue because he was so far away.
Yeah. Well, and by now you're 4+ years into the relationship too.
Right.
So you have all of this, like, you've built out the narrative. This is your person. So when people tell you this is not okay, you're like, yeah, but my storyline says differently.
Mm-hmm. And so I think she was like, you need my boss. She continued the conversation and she was basically like, this isn't healthy. This isn't okay. You need to go back to your dorm room. Like, leave your shift. Again, middle of my shift. You need to leave work, go back to your dorm room, call him, message him, FaceTime him, do whatever it is you communicate since he's in Europe, and break up with him. Like, this is the best time to do it. He can't come here. He can't talk you into coming up to his school. Go back, break up with him, and then come back to my office to tell me you did it. And so for her to be that invested in my personal life and my personal relationship as someone who up until that point I just saw as my boss, like I saw her as like a friend, but first and foremost, she was my boss. And so for her to be this external person telling me that my relationship isn't healthy and that it's problematic and basically saying everything that my mom and my brother have been saying for the past 5 years, I was like, oh shit, maybe they're right. Maybe this isn't okay. And so I did. I went back to my dorm room. I broke up with him. I ended the relationship and I went back to her office and I told her I did it. The issue is that another coworker at the rec center was also kind of at the same time telling me that it wasn't a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. And I saw him as the person that was treating me right. Like,
right.
He was nice. He was supportive. He was encouraging. So after ending the relationship with the first guy, I immediately started a relationship with the second guy.
And I think just like holding space for that version of you, like mm-hmm. loving her, you know?
Yes. And I thought it's like, oh, like he's seeing me at this really low point and still taking time to be my friend and be there for me and be supportive. So maybe he's a good guy, but really,
it was an opportunity.
It was an opportunity. Sure. So abusers and narcissists and problematic people like that, they prey on that vulnerability. They look for that weakness and they prey on it.
You had the right energy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I had the energy that, oh, this is someone that I can manipulate. This is someone that I can make do whatever I want them to do.
Yeah.
And thankfully, not thankfully, that's probably a poor word choice, but this second relationship started to show signs of heading towards physical abuse. So I was able to see it sooner and on my own that it was very unhealthy and not a safe space for me. So I ended that one after a year. But yeah, so 6 years, two relationships back to back, both very manipulative, very controlling, and in different ways.
Okay. So I'm so grateful that you're in a healthy relationship and I've met your partner.
Like, going on 10 years too. This summer will be 10 years.
That's wild. That's wild. It's just, it's, we do heal. You know, of course, with all of this, I'm always such a like, we have to make all of this productive person. And so we have to look at it and call it what it truly is and understand it, which is what you've done the work to do. And then I got to figure out how to get on the other side of this thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so you saw the signs in the second one that it was headed a bad direction. It was already there. It was already in a bad spot. And you're like, oh, been here, done this. This doesn't look like a good idea. I'm going to bounce out. Were you already studying this sort of thing, or were those relationships, like, you're in college mm-hmm. and now you're a PhD student researcher, all of these things. When did you start to turn your gaze towards like, now I'm going to really focus a lot of energy on understanding these types of behaviors?
So my undergrad degrees are, I have one in psychology and one in criminal justice.
So you were already working in the psych field in some way?
Yes, but yeah. not in this direction.
Yeah.
So my original goal was to be a child psychologist and specifically work with abused children, right? I had met this one little girl at a different point in my life, and she was very heavily abused, and I wanted to be someone that helped kids like that. So that was my goal, which, side note, back to the first controlling partner, right? As soon as I mentioned to him that I wanted to be a child psychologist, which would mean getting my doctorate in psychology and to become a psychologist, mm-hmm. one of his comments was, oh, well, now I have to figure out what to get a doctorate in because I can't have you have a degree higher than me. I won't be doctor and mister. So I got to figure out what kind of doctorate I'm going to get.
My brain. I was like, what? Anyway.
So ended up not going that route. I kind of stumbled into criminal justice and wanted to just tack it on to my education instead of completely switch. And then it wasn't until after I was out of both of those relationships and after I was done with college that I stumbled upon domestic violence as like a field to dive into.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for work because I was just out of college, and I worked at basically a juvenile detention facility for almost a year, and quit that job because that wasn't for me at all.
I'm sure that was very hard.
Yes. That's actually how I met Corey for the second time, because he also worked there for a short time. Corey's my current partner, but
shout out Corey.
And so I didn't have a job because I quit the juvenile detention facility so suddenly, and I didn't really have a backup. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine worked at a domestic violence shelter, and she's like, hey, I can get you at least a part-time job as like a crisis worker in the evening. So I would answer the phones, answer the crisis hotline. I would do intakes for new residents and basically just be a staff member that was at the shelter for anything the residents needed at the time. And so I did that part-time for a little bit. I didn't even know domestic violence victim advocate was a thing. And I think that is something that is really common for people, even people that study criminal justice. They don't, like, academically, criminal justice programs focus mainly on like how the courts function, how law enforcement functions, and how corrections function. So how jails and prisons function. It's getting more common in like present day, but it's not super common for academic programs to focus on victim services. And because honestly, that kind of starts to bleed into like social work territory. Mm-hmm. But so I didn't even know that was an option. And, you know, having the experiences I had, having the past that I had, I was like, okay, that might be fun. At least it's income for now, because I didn't have a job.
Yeah.
And then I absolutely fell in love with the work, and it was really hard work.
Yeah.
But I transitioned into a full-time role as, it was called the Youth Services Coordinator. So basically I would go around to like middle schools and high schools in the communities that we served, and I would do prevention presentations to the students and even to like the educators. So basically, what can students, how can they recognize abusive relationships? What can they do if they find themselves in an abusive relationship? And for the teachers, like, how can they see the signs in their students that they are struggling in a controlling relationship or something like this? And what can they do to help those students? Mm-hmm. And I loved the prevention work more than I liked the basically the crisis and reactive work. I liked all of the work, but just prevention and trying to stop it before it even happened was where my true passion was, because I didn't have that person. I didn't have anyone coming into my school to teach me what a healthy relationship is, right? Kids don't know how to date. They don't know what a relation, what a healthy relationship necessarily means or what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And so I really dove into, I want to be that person. Like, I want to be the person that I didn't have. Mm-hmm.
In the first one, it sounds like I have a couple of thoughts. Your first one, that's the longest one, even though a year is still a sufficient amount of time to develop a connection that you then have to figure out how to dissipate. And that's an emotional journey, to say the least. The first one, it's someone else says, this is a, and someone that you can finally hear says, this is a problem. And you say, okay. And you take their advice and you cut it off. And they were not nearby, which made it a little bit easier because they were not near proximity where they could actually get their hands on you. But did you experience struggle? Like, were you able to just cut, like, close that door and leave the door closed? Or did you find yourself wanting to go back? Because you had 5 years, right? So even, like, I would imagine there were probably moments where you maybe questioned your decision. Like, was that right? Is that actually, was that, or by the time that you arrived there, were you like, I know this is right?
So that wasn't the first time I broke up with him, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Before we even graduated high school, I had broken up with him because I entered something into a like community art show or something, and I won first place for it, right? So I was really excited, and this other friend I had from my bowling league on the weekends or whatever, I texted him and I let him know that I won. He was a good friend, whatever. And my boyfriend at the time saw the text and he thought that that meant that I was cheating with this guy.
Sure.
And he's like, why are you talking to him? Because monitoring who I was talking to was something that he did very regularly. And that was just really odd to me that he was ruining this thing that was supposed to be a happy moment in my life. Like, I just won an art show as someone who never won anything in her life because I didn't consider myself good at anything.
Yeah.
Right. So I didn't like that he was accusing me of cheating like that blatantly. Mm-hmm. So I broke up with him. It lasted a week, right? We talked every day during the week we were broken up.
Sure.
He wouldn't let me forget about him. He wouldn't let me move on. And that was right around our senior prom time. And it just, he wouldn't leave me alone. So he was like, fine, you take someone else to prom. I'll take someone else to prom. Immediately had a girl to ask. So I was like, well, why are you all of a sudden asking this girl like the day after we broke up? What's the deal there? And then finally, like after work one day, I worked at Dairy Queen at the time. And after work, I was like, can I just swing by your house and so we can talk? Can we just talk about stuff? And then an hour later, we were back together.
Yeah.
Because he talked his way back into it. And he said,
sure.
I just get jealous sometimes. You're the only person that like I want to be the only person you talk to. I want to have all of your attention. And so obviously that meant that I couldn't talk to guys. So there went every guy friend I ever had just out the window. I tossed him out.
Yeah. And in the moment you are just desiring being loved, you know, like, or that's what
girl.
Right. Right. And so like to you, you know, you don't know any better. And so this is a sacrifice that this individual is telling you that you need to make. And you're going, okay, maybe this is how this is supposed to be. Maybe I'm supposed to do this. Mm-hmm. I just have a lot of compassion for that. And I think that it's can be really, you get into a situation that would be considered abusive in some form. And I remember when I finally got into a situation that was that way. And it was like, of all people, I would be someone that the outward perception would be Claire's confident, right? And now I've done enough of life to understand that I have to navigate all of my own self-worth, even to this day. Had a conversation a few days ago with my partner where I'm like, this is just a self-love thing. This is just a self-worth thing. Like this is, I just made up your narrative for you, you know? So it's cool to be able to have more tools to understand when that's happening. But I remember being in a situation that was abusive and going, of all people, like I didn't think that this could happen to me. And I don't think the rest of the world thought that that could happen mm-hmm. to me too. So being in it as it was this slippery slope of now you can't do this, go there, talk to these people, you name it, whatever. And I'm like, the walls are closing in. I didn't even, like it's shocking. And it's just sly. I don't know what other term to use for it, but it feels sly because you get further and further in. And then finally you're like, I'm just at a loss for how we even got here. And so just having compassion for the individual who's being manipulated mm-hmm. and then of course I truly have some form of compassion for the manipulator because I go, I don't actually believe that that's who they want to show up as in this world either, but that doesn't mean that it's okay to accept that treatment. Right. So, okay. And in the second one, you recognize it. Was that did you close the door there? I'm curious about the ending of that. Like, what did that look like? Did you go back and forth there?
That one was a messy ending. It wasn't a clean break. It wasn't okay, I'm done. It was just constant arguing, constant gaslighting, and constant, like, he just constantly made me question my sanity. He would openly cheat on me. Didn't care if I knew where he was, but then would come home and tell me I was imagining things, would tell me I wasn't where I knew he was and that I was just crazy. I was making it up.
And you truly did question your own reality.
100%. Like yes. I was in a hard tailspin during that time because it got to a point where I didn't know what was up and what was down. Like I was just so confused the whole time because I lived in a house with him and three of his guy friends, right? And his friends tell me, yeah, he's at so-and-so's apartment. He's at her place tonight. And then he'd come home and say, no, I wasn't. But, you know, there was a point where I got a little bit, I don't even know the word that I want to use for it, but like I tried to like figure out his location, like track my iPhone or whatever. I remember doing that one night because I was just,
you felt crazy,
questioning everything. And I was like, am I really seeing what I'm seeing? Is it really happening? Or am I seeing things? Is my previous relationship just messing everything up? And he really is a good guy and everything's a mess. But the Find My iPhone, no, he was at this other girl's apartment right down the street. But then he came home one night and just completely said that I was making it up. He even accused me of cheating. And then next thing, we were in his kitchen and it was late at night, like almost the middle of the night. Everyone should have been asleep. But next thing I knew, his fist hit the freezer door right next to my head and put a dent in it, like a couple inches from my head. And that was the like, oh, this is bad. I need to not be here anymore. But at that same time, he was saying, you're too crazy. You need to get out. So he was also saying he was done, but he was saying it was my fault. Mm-hmm. And so in the middle of the night, I called my friend and I was like, I actually don't remember if I called her or if he called her from my phone and said, you need to come get her. She needs to get out of this house. She needs to not be here anymore. I actually think that it was him that called my friend in the middle of the night and said, you need to come get her. And she did. And like her and I aren't necessarily close today, but I'm still so appreciative of her for letting me sleep on her couch for that night, just out of the blue.
Yeah.
But the issue was, is that I now had no place to live. So I had to find an apartment in a college town in the middle of the semester.
Right.
So the only thing available was right across the street from him. And so he would constantly text me when he saw me leaving my apartment to go out with friends, calling me all kinds of derogatory names for going out with friends. And, but then the next night, text me and say how much he missed me and asks if he can come over. And I'm still super vulnerable that I said yes all the time. And it was so hard to completely break it off with him because I was still so close to him. Mm-hmm. But then I finally had enough and I cut him off. I blocked his number. I told his friends, his roommates, you know, don't let him come over here. Like, don't let him talk to me anymore. Like, I can't leave this apartment. I'm stuck here for the rest of this lease, but I can't keep doing this.
Yeah. So in these situations, I want to go now and thank you for choosing to share all of this. Like we talked about, you know, just you using your voice is powerful and people will identify. And so getting into those moments that were scary and weird and hard and lonely and confusing and disorienting, all of it, it's really helpful. And honestly, as we're sitting here in this conversation, this is now giving me the opportunity to reflect on past relationships and stuff, and even just the like manipulation thing. And what's cool is I can understand now, like I have the capacity to see all the ways in which I, as a person, was so unhealthy myself that I wasn't, I mean, I remember towards the end of alcoholism as a part of my journey. Most people here know that I'm in recovery. And towards the end of my alcoholism journey, like I would tell men that would be interested in me, like I would be like, if you're looking for some girl to like really date, I'm not it, because I'm not the version of me that's going to attract a partner that I actually want. And how sad is that, that I was at a place where I could fully acknowledge that, communicate that to another individual, but I was not yet ready to actually do the work myself. But so it's just interesting because you're speaking and you're giving me the opportunity to reflect back on relationships that I don't even have. Like I truly just, forgiveness is a really cool thing. And whenever you can identify all the ways in which you needed to heal, like it makes it a little bit less tough. Anyway, I can see some of the ways where all of this passive stuff took place in my life, where I allowed someone, like I knew that they weren't attending a college that they said they were attending for years. They said they, for years I was in this relationship. I was like, well, like I know they're lying to me, but whatever. Enough of this other stuff is fine. So anyway, and that's not like, that's on me now too. Mm-hmm. So it's just cool. Thank you for exposing me to your experiences and helping me better understand mine. Love this podcast format where we say things we don't know if we're sure that we want to say publicly. I love it here. Anyway, okay. I truly do. So now you've twice now left relationships. Mm-hmm. It was sticky, messy, confusing, hard. What are some tools that you used? Like when you got away from these relationships, what were things that helped you?
So first, there were some unhealthy things that I tried, especially after the second relationship. I basically just didn't want to feel the things anymore. So I was going out all the time, going out to bars with friends, drinking way too much. And I think the thing that made me realize that I was on a really unhealthy track was the what I call kind of my rock bottom, my like, holy shit, this is getting very, very, very bad and very, very, very dangerous. So again, I was going out all the time, going to bars, because it was a college town, basically.
That's what you do.
Yeah, the town where I went to college, if the university wasn't there, the town would probably not exist anymore.
Yeah.
It's really all that town has. So there were a lot of bars to go to, and just pretty much every night, even if I had to open at the rec center the next morning and be there at 5:30 in the morning, every night I was going out.
Mm-hmm.
And never turned down one more drink. Always was down for it, always said yes. And at one point, I honestly don't know if I've talked about this publicly yet. I know Corey knows about it because Corey knows all my, I don't have secrets from him, but I don't think I've talked about it publicly yet. So there was one night I went out with a friend, and she wasn't really a good friend. She was just a friend that wanted to go out. So I was like, sure, let's go.
Totally.
And got way too drunk, and we met these guys, and they were in town for, I don't even know, work, I think, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked us into going back to their hotel with them. To this day, I cannot tell you what hotel that was. Cannot tell you whose car I got there in. Cannot tell you that guy's name. Cannot tell you what he looks like. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
All I remember is agreeing to go to his hotel, being in a hotel, and then having that moment like, I need to not be here anymore. I need to be home. Thankfully, and I will thank whatever made this happen, thankfully he was someone who agreed to take me home when I asked him to. And he dropped me off at home, no questions asked, no problem. And just fully understanding how bad that could have gone, mm-hmm. and how problematic and dangerous of a situation I was in,
mm-hmm.
I was like, this is not the way. This isn't the way to get through my shit. This isn't the way to fix my problems. And so, sorry.
No, it's okay.
So that was kind of the turning point and the, I need to just focus on me. I need to not think about guys. I need to not think about relationships. I need to figure out what I'm trying to do with my life. And mm-hmm. I need to solely focus on fixing myself.
Yeah. I love you. So it's so powerful to be able to look at things like to look and okay, that's really what that was. And to feel what you like as you're sitting there, like, now I have chills. Because my own experiences are different than yours, but you're like, I understand you. And I'm so grateful that that experience ended the way that it did, as far as being able to be taken home and to move forward and that be that. And I'm also so sorry that it got there, you know? I get it. So what are some healthy tools? Let's go to the healthy tools.
Doing things that continuously prove to myself that I can do hard things, jujitsu being one of them.
Did you start that right then, or did that come later?
No, that came later. Corey is actually how I got into jujitsu, and I started dating Corey in 2014, and that was probably like maybe a year, give or take a month or two after that. Like, I got to focus on me and not worry about finding a partner.
About a year later?
Yeah.
Awesome.
And we just happened to be in the same space.
Yeah, you worked together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we worked together at the rec center too. I actually met him in like 2011, and partially I didn't think that like he was a personality that I would get along with. So I didn't really like want to become his friend, but also like I was still in that relationship where I couldn't have friends, let alone guy friends, so like I didn't even try.
Yeah.
And then we both quit at the rec center, and then we both started working at the juvenile detention center around the same time and became best friends. Just each other is how we decompressed from super long 16-hour shifts at that place.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just realized that we really liked spending time together, and so we started dating. It wasn't anything I was looking for. It wasn't anything he was looking for. He had his own past relationships that he was just trying to focus on himself and he wasn't looking either. But so Corey is how I got into jujitsu, and I started jujitsu in 2014, and I only trained for like 6 or 8 months, but I had a lot of chronic pain at the time that I didn't get figured out until years later. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't like fully get into jujitsu because
yeah, my if you body have chronic pain and you go like get twisted around a lot, you know, it's just, like
yeah,
it's like, not I wasn't a fun I, experience.
Yeah. I wasn't physically fit. I wasn't. It just wasn't a good time.
Yeah.
So I quit, but Corey kept training, and he knew that like I would eventually get back to it, but that he couldn't like
push
me too hard because I scare easily. And so he needed to just let it happen in its own time. And then in 2020, we moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and he started training at Derby City MMA, which is the head coach there is Nick Chewy, Albin Chewy is his nickname. And he's like a really high level person in jujitsu, and it's an excellent gym. And finally I started training again just on my own, and the chronic pain stuff was figured out by then. It mm-hmm. ended up being food allergies that function as an autoimmune disease.
Interesting.
And just fell in love with it. So doing hard things on a regular basis, especially jujitsu, which is something where you constantly find yourself in a compromised position, and just learning like, no, I'm okay. I'm not in as tough of a spot as I think I am, and yeah. I can take a second to breathe and to work out of it. And it's such an individualized sport that even though I'm not an athletic person, I don't have an athletic build, I'm not super in shape.
I would challenge you in this moment to disregard that and not ever say that again.
Okay.
You are no longer not an athletic person. You are now an athletic person.
Well, that's what I thought. Like, now I consider myself an athlete. I've been doing jujitsu for a little over 3 years at this point, and there are certain things that I'm pretty good at.
Okay. All right. I was say we're not carrying that narrative any further, but okay. We've already given it up. Good. Great.
But, you know, like, it's just when I started jujitsu, I thought I wasn't athletic. I thought I wasn't in shape. So just learning like, oh no, I can do something this physical, and it's the most physically demanding thing I've ever done in my life.
It's hard.
Just, and also just surrounding myself with good people. Like, yeah. Just, I don't have the energy or the time or the patience for any kind of level of like narcissism. I don't put up with it. I'm not confrontational with it or combative with it. I'm just, I'll cut you off real quick. I'll cut you out real quick. And I won't pursue friendships like that. And I only surround myself with people who are excited to be doing the things they're doing, but are also supportive, encouraging, and, you know, just good people.
Yeah. Well, so you've studied it now, and now you understand signs of what you talked about, the narcissism thing, which I think it's interesting to just note that, like, by nature, we are the center of our own universe. And so being a selfish creature is kind of like a normal thing. And then we just have to work to like not just operate that way, knowing that that's kind of like our default setting, at least for me and most of the people that I hang out with, like would agree that that's a default setting that we have to work ourselves out of. And it's, you know, anyway, what are some traits that you know of that turn you away whenever you meet somebody that you, you know, the narcissistic stuff that you go, I don't want to hang out around that. Like, I don't want that energy. Like, what are those things that you avoid today?
This is probably more so because it just reminds me of the second guy, but a lot of the like bro-y kind of nature, like the bro mentality, the people that think they're better than everyone else, just guys that think they're better than everyone else, that just, you can just pick up on like subtle things, like subtle facial expressions that, and just subtle comments that like, you just kind of get the idea where they think that they are better than whoever they're around.
And so people who put off an energy that says I'm superior to you for any reason.
Yeah.
Got it.
And just, there's just a certain warmth that I look for in people. And for anyone that knows you, like, you are basically the definition of that warmth.
Thank you. And it's, yeah, I don't know. It's been really cool personally to go from the journey. And I will say, when I think of like, if, thank you so much. And I pray every morning to show up that way, because it's, yet again, I have to work myself out of the default selfish setting. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's such a useful tool for me today, which a few years ago when I was told that I was going to do that, I was like, no, I'm not. But was desperate and willing. I used to be a person who engaged in gossip a ton and did think that. And so it's just, it's, the point of even saying anything like that, I guess, is just that that's something that you can strive towards, you know, to be a person who is warm and to be a person who does actually genuinely want the best for others. And those are simple things like when you catch yourself in a conversation about another individual that's not supportive, why are you in that conversation and should you remove yourself? And it's not so that you can look cool to others, but because it's false connection and it doesn't fulfill you. At least in my experience, that's what it came. I came to understand that's not truly connecting. And I don't actually want to engage in this sort of behavior. Mm-hmm. And so then stopping doing that now, I don't even know how to, like, I don't know. And then it gives me the opportunity too, to like be stoked on people's, like the more you can just get stoked on when people do well, you get to be more warm, you know?
So, but also, like, that wasn't a quick thing to get used to and to look for in people. Not just like my relationships, but my friendships. It was something that took a lot of time. And honestly, sometimes I'm still like, Corey is beyond supportive and encouraging of me and my abilities. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of hard to get used to, because it was just what I wasn't. It was the exact opposite of what I was used to. And so when him and I started dating, and he was just all on board for my goals and my dreams and what I wanted out of life and who I wanted to be, I was honestly trying to figure out who I wanted to be at that time.
Yeah.
And he was just like, yeah, you can do that. Like, and he's just listing out these things that he thinks I'm good at. And I'm like, you think I'm capable? You think I'm good at things? Where's the...
What's your angle? What's your angle?
What's happening?
Yeah.
But, and so like, it was hard to get used to, but now like it's that, and obviously like I'm not looking for people to like dote on me and, you know, put me on a pedestal, mm-hmm. but having a strong support system is crucial,
yeah.
especially after experiences where all people have done is tear you down. And yeah. not just my partners, like that first controlling relationship, his parents were just as bad to each other and to me. Like when I picked up that second major of criminal justice and was a dual major, his dad literally said, like, are you sure you can handle two majors? Like you struggled in high school and you're struggling now with one major. Are you sure you're smart enough? And
how did you overcome that?
I didn't really have a response to him. I just kind of did it anyways. And I was like, I guess if I fail, then I fail. But what later I like had the thought, like, you had no idea that the reason I was struggling, I didn't say this to him, but it was just like an internal conversation I had. I was like, you have no idea that the reason I struggled in high school and the reason I struggled in undergrad was because of your son.
Yeah.
It's right. Because he was talking me out of going to class so that I could stay in my dorm room, not interacting with people and FaceTiming him and talking to him, so that I could cut class on Mondays to spend an extra day up at his school on the weekend. And it was just his stepmom was just as bad too. There was one point where, it's not the best language, so sorry in advance, but there was one point I was a teenager, so still a minor, mm-hmm. and she referred to me as a piece of pussy to my face. She was trying to test whether or not I would stand up for myself, whether he would stand up for me, and what his reaction would be, what my reaction would be. And that's a grown woman talking to a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And so his parents were, so I had like all of these people in my life that were constantly tearing me down, constantly putting into question my self-worth and my capabilities and what I thought I wanted to do in life, that it's such a hard jump to the other side that it took so much time to get used to having someone in my corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that was jarring to be like, wait, what? I think it's been the coolest thing about my newer relationship with Jimmy, which, by the way, he's a black belt. Did you know that?
I think I saw that on Instagram and I was like, oh, that's super cool.
Yeah, no, he's very inspiring to me and he's smart and I think he's cool. Anyway, he is so different than anyone I've dated historically. And it's so I feel like I'm in the middle of early stages of something that you're speaking about as far as like, it's so different. And when he wants to communicate through struggle or wants to, you know, and I'm like, or has his own life and isn't just like, and now you're the center of my universe. Cause that's what I thought that I liked.
Yep.
And so it's been jarring to
be
like,
what I thought a relationship had to be like, I thought you had to be connected all the time and you were the only thing that mattered and they were the only thing that mattered.
And then to know that that actually truly isn't what you desired. Mm-hmm. It's so empowering. And to be able to regulate yourself and then to have somebody believe in you. And the fact that you get to use your voice and you don't have a partner today telling you, shut up, go sit down, don't talk about that. Like the value in that. Like shout out to Corey for choosing to be like, yeah, go use your voice. That's so cool. So today, because you do work in this field, what are resources that you would recommend? It's a person who realizes that they have this repeated pattern of behavior. They're not in a situation they want to be in. They would like to gain some more autonomy. What would you tell them?
Well, there are, every state in the country has various shelters, various nonprofit organizations that help current victims and survivors. So just because you aren't currently in a situation doesn't mean you can't reach out to organizations like that for services.
Yeah, and get some help.
Even though I'm well past those relationships.
Yeah.
Because there's still some things that I'm actively working on.
Yeah.
I could still reach out to an organization if I felt like I couldn't do it on my own, if I felt like I needed those resources, whether it be counseling or anything like that. Mm. And they would help me even though I've been out of those relationships for 10 years. So don't think that just because you've been out of it for a while doesn't mean you can't reach out for help.
Gosh, yeah.
There's online resources. But sometimes it can be tricky because it, like a lot of those nonprofits, they're funded through grants. They only have limited resources because they might be smaller in size. They might be operating out of like a more rural area. So they just might not have the ability to have like a lot of resources for people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one of my goals. And what I'm trying to do is share my knowledge, share my experiences, and share just resources aside from like emergency shelter. Obviously, I can't provide emergency shelter for people, but I can share the ins and outs of domestic violence. I can share facts about domestic violence, signs of it, just all of the information I've gathered between my personal experiences and my professional experiences over the last, at this point, 15 years, and share them. So I write a weekly newsletter. And at first it started as just like a, these are things that helped me over the years. Mm-hmm. But now I'm starting to like pivot it more to a direction where I talk about specific things about domestic violence. Like one issue I talked about common myths that people have about domestic violence. Then I think,
what's a common myth? Let's hear one. And we'll put in the show notes the your newsletter so that people can go get that. So just so you know now, that'll be there. But what's a common myth?
Oh, there's a bunch.
What's your like top one?
But basically, so another issue with shelter is that a lot of people think, well, why didn't they just leave? There are shelters they could go to. They say they didn't have anywhere to go. They can just go to a shelter. But not everyone can, right? One, shelters can be scary places.
Totally.
They're
even just being a person who thinks that you need shelters already. I mean, that's mm-hmm. scary in and of itself.
It's hard to admit.
Right.
That you need that level of help.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to uproot your life and leave. And a shelter is communal living. Like you're living with strangers in a traumatic time.
Mm-hmm.
And so not everyone is comfortable to go to a shelter. A lot of times domestic violence comes with it goes hand in hand with addiction. And a lot of shelters are not able to have people stay there if they are actively dealing with addiction, mm-hmm. because it's just unsafe for everyone involved, right? It's unsafe for the person coming into the shelter. It's unsafe for the other residents. It's unsafe for the staff.
So then at that point, it would be like a treatment center for that individual. If they are suffering with both, then maybe the treatment center. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not an expert here whatsoever. I just simply am like thinking of ideas that I know people go to treatment centers, you know, obviously with recovery being a big part of my life and addiction being my history. That's a common.
And another reason that a lot of people won't go to a shelter is something that people would never think of. And it's because they aren't willing. And some people think it sounds ridiculous, but a lot of people aren't willing to leave their pets behind because either their dog or their cat, or we even had past clients at the shelter I worked at that their pet was a bird and they weren't willing to leave their bird, mm-hmm. and they can't bring their pet to the shelter because of liability issues. Like the grants that fund the shelter, you can't just let people bring their animals because then it becomes
humans
a liability.
Plus zoo. Yeah.
They can bring a service animal, but they can't bring just their everyday pet.
Yeah.
And so either their pet has been their biggest coping mechanism during this abusive relationship and their biggest like focus of peace. So they don't want to leave their pet behind. They don't want to live without their pet. Mm-hmm. Or their abusers say, if you leave me, I will kill this dog, or I will hurt your pet. I will do something to your animal. And
that's enough to stop them.
It's sure. enough to keep them from leaving.
Sure. Okay. So those types of, so what if somebody doesn't want to go live somewhere else, but so like, you know, cause that's a drastic measure. And obviously if you're in a situation that's really bad, then like sometimes drastic measures need to be taken. But, what are other supportive things that would be less uprooting, even though at the end of the day, when it comes to this topic, an uproot kind of has to happen. But what are other things? Cause you even mentioned, you know, even though I'm somebody that's far out down the road from my acute situation of I'm actively in it to now I've like gotten out of it and done a lot of other things, you still need support because you're a human. Mm-hmm. And this is a topic that's very near and dear to you. It's just like me with recovery. I stay very plugged in to my community who understands me and can support me based on the principles and values that I'm trying to live by that were taught to me by them. And so support for anybody who does identify with this, whether it's the in the moment right now, or it's just, this is a part of my past. And I actually still like could use some more tools to like better understand why I do what I do, have done what I've done, have been where I've been.
Mm-hmm. Now obviously like everyone's situation is different,
yes.
right? I can't offer suggestions for people that are going to work for everyone because yeah. everyone's situation is different.
Yeah.
And it sounds kind of like a write-off, but the victim slash survivor is the expert of their situation, right? So they know the most about their situation. They know when they're the safest. They know when they're the most in danger. And so basically you just kind of let them kind of decide. And maybe that means they're not ready to leave yet. Maybe that means, unfortunately, they stay in that relationship for now. Because they have to be willing to leave. They have to be ready to leave. And forcing someone to leave or forcing someone to file a police report is almost just doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's taking away their autonomy. It's taking away their choice. And obviously, we'd want everyone to be able to leave their situation, everyone to get away from their abusive partners. But they know their situation best. So sometimes abusers are not super dangerous all the time, mm-hmm. to where it's still possible for someone to not necessarily become a resident at a shelter, but they're able to do counseling through the shelter. So they're able to go to a location maybe weekly, maybe biweekly, whatever, and do counseling and work through everything. And then maybe eventually they build up the courage and ability to leave, or maybe they never do. Maybe they're never willing to leave for reasons A through Z.
Maybe their partner gets healthy.
And that is possible. And it's super tricky because they have to do their own work.
Right.
Because a lot of times, and this doesn't excuse any behavior at all, but it gives a reason to it. Abusers, more often than not, have been abused.
Sure.
One way or another.
Yep.
And no one just wakes up one day and says, I want to be abusive.
Yeah.
There's trauma that comes with it.
That... I want to pause right there because I want to talk about this resource that I told you. I've got like these books laying out. She's like, I see it. I know. This has been a really cool topic because I say a cool topic. This is a heavy topic. But I was reading Dr. Peter Attia's book, Outlive, which is the science and art of longevity. He is a medical doctor who wrote a phenomenal book that came out last year. And so the whole, it's like a textbook. You actually just ordered it. Mm-hmm. So it's like a literal textbook. This thing's massive, but it's amazing. And it's just all about longevity. How do we optimize our health? How do we understand the four horsemen diseases and what we can do with our lifestyle factors and so on? And so it's very like nutrition, movement, sleep, things like that, right? Textbook. It's incredible. Everybody should read it. Anyway, the last chapter in the book is emotional health. And I don't want to quote incorrectly, but I believe that Dr. Peter Attia, he walked through some of his own experience in this final chapter. So he actually exposed himself to just explaining a bit more of how he spent his career working really diligently on understanding how to optimize the human experience and go for longevity and live forever, right? And then he goes in this back chapter, he's like, oh, by the way, also emotional health is really, really important and we got to get that in check in order to do all these other things as well. And I can say from my own experience, my emotional health was suffering so dramatically that it was impacting the people that I love negatively. And so he shares about that, which is powerful. He used a quote and he I believe, if I read correctly, that he went inpatient for this twice within the past handful of years. So just very powerful to hear that vulnerability from this person. But he quoted an individual that the quote stood out to me so much that I was like, highlighted it, bought the book by that author that he referenced, and am reading it now. And it's really cool. So it's a gentleman named Terrence Real. And the quote is, family pathology rolls from generation to generation like a fire in the woods, taking down everything in its path until one person in one generation has the courage to turn and face the flames. That person brings peace to his ancestors and spares the children that follow. I wanted to be that person. And so that just like really jumped out at me. And obviously when it comes to the abuser and so on, they've often been abused. This was speaking to family pathology, but it doesn't obviously always have to be a family member that has abused. And so I'm reading the book now that's by that author, Terrence Real. It's called I Don't Want to Talk About It. And it's about overcoming the secret legacy of male depression. And it's just been quite interesting so far to read about this like passive trauma that people experience. And even if it isn't that, you know, what we talked about earlier. Anyway, I just want to bring up those other resources for the fact that these books, like this book is addressing men and their anger and how they have to internalize so much because society allows the woman the capacity to like speak more freely about her emotional experience and outreach for support. Whereas men, it's more internalize it, just deal with it, don't talk about it, there's not a problem, whatever. And both sexes do that, right? But for this, I just am enjoying this book saying that that will come out in maybe different forms of addiction, love addiction, sex addiction, alcohol, drugs, whatever, codependent behavior, but it can also come out in anger. And so anyway, I think I'll shut up about that there. But I wanted to make reference to those because they help us understand why people behave the way that they behave.
And like even so that helps understand why people abuse a little bit better, but it also speaks to a little bit more on the victim side as well, because people who have been abused are more likely to engage in more abusive relationships and continue to go from one abuser to another abuser to another abuser to another abuser. And I think a lot of that is because our self-worth is challenged so hard that we don't think that we're worthy and we don't think that we deserve quote-unquote healthy love, and we don't even necessarily know what that looks like. And again, like we talked about before, from me going from the first relationship to the second relationship, the narcissists and abusive people, they prey on those things and they're able to easily see those things. And so it's really common to see that cycle and going from one abusive relationship to another. And it's really amazing to see people finally like break mm-hmm. that line. But also within one abusive relationship, like I think statistically, and this may have changed, I haven't like looked at this statistic.
2023's version.
Yeah. Sure. I haven't looked at the statistic in a little while, so it might have changed. If I'm willing to bet, it the numbers have just gotten larger, not smaller. But as far as I'm aware, it takes roughly 7 to 9 times for someone to leave an abusive partner for good. Like they will leave and go back to them a handful of times mm-hmm. before they break up with them for good. And like I said, I broke up with the first guy for a week and went back. And so that repetition is there even within each relationship as well.
Yeah.
And it's so working as a victim advocate. Again, obviously we would never say you can't go back to them. You have to stay here at the shelter because again, that takes away
their agency.
It kind of brings into question the rapport that we worked so hard to build with them. Mm-hmm. So we would always just say like, you know, we would try to like help them see that maybe it wasn't a good idea, but ultimately if they wanted to go back, then we wouldn't stop them. We would just let them know that the door is always open. They can always come back. And getting to that point where they finally draw the line, they don't go back, they're completely done and they leave their abuser for the final time. It's one of the most incredible things to witness. Mm. And because it's such a difficult choice to make that it's just, you can feel the shift in their life taking place.
Yep. Yeah. Well, that comes down to that self-worth thing of, oh my gosh, I am a person who is capable. It just can't be, I don't know, undervalued. Mm-hmm. I mean, to arrive there takes a lot of hard work mm-hmm. and bumping into walls. We actually started to talk about this topic before we clicked record. And I was like, we need to just shut up because I want to record right now. And I was asking you, like, we like to read books. We were both making book recommendations talking about books. And I was asking if a group that you're in, if it's self-help type stuff. And you made an interesting comment about how some of that isn't necessarily always your favorite. And can you just kind of expand upon what you said there?
Yeah. So sometimes a lot of like self-help books, especially self-help books that are geared towards women, are a little bit more like they focus on the emotional side. They focus on, I don't want to say like the touchy-feely side, but they're
that's okay.
A little maybe bit it is more like soft, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that those are wrong. They are definitely helpful to a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
but that's just not how I always receive information the best.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I am a highly emotional person, I cry if I feel too much of any emotion, if I'm too happy, if I'm too sad, if I'm too mad, it all comes out in tears. So I'm a very highly emotional person and a highly sensitive person, but sometimes I need information to be conveyed to me, like just straight to the point, blunt, real, straightforward.
Yeah.
No fluff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so like I'm different than a lot of women.
Yeah.
Like I think that sometimes I just don't function that way. And so it's a little bit more helpful for me to not have that flowery kind of talk.
Mm-hmm. I think this is cool. I was actually listening to a podcast today. It was, of course, Chris Williamson's Modern Wisdom podcast. I just think he makes a great product there. And he was interviewing a woman that's talking about women's psychological stuff today. And one of the interesting things that they were unpacking there was about how we have a lot of male leaders today that are speaking publicly in this very direct, like, you need to do the work. You know, maybe that's actually a bad action and you shouldn't take it. Maybe you shouldn't be proud of, you know, whatever. There's a lot of that narrative coming from male figures. And they were just speaking about like having more of that for females from females, mm-hmm. and how we can be really like in our feels and it's okay, you know, whatever. And to kind of be like, yeah, in order, like for me, in order for me to have the self-love that I want to have, the self-worth that I want to have, I have also got to accompany that with tremendous action mm-hmm. to support that. Like if I'm not taking the actions of an individual that I can be proud of, then what am I doing? You know? And so like to remove some of the flowery nature of it and to make it a bit more blunt and to be like, yeah, the way that you feel good is by taking esteemable action.
Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know that I'd go so far to say like, I function better with tough love because I do believe in compassion. I do believe in totally. Giving people grace and giving yourself grace and being kind to yourself and all these other things. But I think there's this balance that sometimes people struggle with of being firm with yourself and giving yourself boundaries and sticking to those boundaries and making excuses for yourself. Mm-hmm. And so
it's bargaining. It's bargaining with yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can make a boundary for myself, but if I don't stick to that boundary and then maybe I'm like, oh, well, it's okay. Like, obviously I'm not going to be perfect every time, but I don't need to cushion things for myself. I need the clear, like I need things to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I think that's because I went through so much manipulation and so much like false narratives from other people and so much just fakeness from other people
yeah.
that I benefit so much from people just being
honest.
And this is it. This is what you need to do. And this is how it needs to be. Mm-hmm. And maybe it doesn't work, but I'm not going to know it doesn't work until I try it. But yep. I need it to be that straightforward. Even in jujitsu sometimes. Like sometimes I'll tell like Corey or Destiny, the women's coach, and Lauren Sears, the other women's coach, like I'll tell them like sometimes you just gotta yell at me.
Yeah.
like yell at me and then I will know that I'm doing it wrong and I won't do it anymore. But if you try and like
sugarcoat it,
be nice about it, or say like, well, maybe that's not the best thing to be doing in that situation, it's not going to click in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that like I need people to be rude to me or mean to me. I'm saying I need them to be clear.
Yep. Clarity is kindness. Yeah. And honesty is such a, I'm so in this like do not lie phase of life where like even if it's going to make everybody uncomfortable and don't be rude, like you talked about, but do not lie. It's such a big thing. Okay. So we're going to have to land the plane. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask and just thank you for mm-hmm. your time and energy and choosing to spend it in this way and share your experiences. I know that it's going to be relatable for people. And so if they want to get on your newsletter, if they want to consume more of what you have to offer about this, if they want to connect directly with you and speak to you about those resources in an intimate way, how can they find you? Where can they do that?
Yep. It is a free weekly newsletter that I put out on Substack and it's called Women Empowered. And you can look at it through Substack or you can get it in your email inbox every week. But it's free every week. It's every Monday morning. And it's called Women Empowered, but honestly, it's applicable to anyone because domestic violence affects anyone. Mm-hmm. It can affect everyone. It just so happens that women are not even necessarily the people it most commonly affects, but they tend to be sometimes the ones that reach out more. But honestly, I've got a lot of guys that are subscribers and I've got guys that comment on my issues every week and say that it's valuable information. So it's called Women Empowered, but it can be applicable to anybody.
Love it. Okay. Yeah. That'll be in the show notes. I do also want to ask, what are three things that you're grateful for today?
I listened to your podcast. So I knew you were going to ask this. I'm trying to think about it.
Yeah.
I think today specifically, I'm thankful for this Austin weather and Austin in general. This is the furthest south I've ever lived. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh and then I lived in like Tennessee and Kentucky and West Virginia as well. And so I'm not used to warm weather in February and in March. And I'm not used to super pretty flowers this early in the year. Like I pulled over on the side of the road yesterday to get out and take a picture of the blue bonnets.
Yeah, they're everywhere. They're so pretty.
So definitely appreciative of that. I think I am also appreciative of my intelligence and my ability to recognize my intelligence, especially after having it brought into question so often and for so long and during some of the most formidable years of my life when I'm supposed to be trying to figure out who I am and who I want to be. And third, I've talked about jujitsu quite a bit in this time, and I'm definitely appreciative of jujitsu. Both the gym in Kentucky that I mentioned earlier, but also 10th Planet here in Austin. It's unmatched. Like, it's unmatched.
Yeah.
The women's program is amazing. The overall instruction is amazing. The people in general are amazing. They've built something incredible there that I just can't commend it enough.
Yeah. Those are good. Oh, I love them. Okay. So my three gratitudes today, mentors and being able to be a mentor. I, in the past 24 hours, have had the opportunity to have conversations with people who mentor me in business and in personal life. And I've also had the opportunity to speak to women that I mentor, whether it's in their health or it's in their addiction struggle or different things like that. And those things, community, social support, accountability, they cannot be undervalued. And so to get to have those people in my life today that I can call and will answer, and to be a person today that when someone calls me, I'll answer. Like a few years ago, I just wasn't that person. I didn't have the mentors and I certainly didn't have anybody asking me for advice. Nope. So it's really cool. Very grateful for that. I'm also grateful for, this is just a recurring theme, but I'm thinking I write gratitudes every morning. And so I think Jimmy has been on my gratitude list every single day this week. And so for today, I'll just say that just like I'm grateful for him because he gives me the opportunity to learn in real time. And like I talked about with the, you're showing up differently than I've been exposed to in the past. I'm having to learn how to self-regulate and so on. And just the like compassion that shows up there. Mm-hmm. I just really appreciate that. And then the third thing is books. We've been talking about books and like the fact that we get access to so much information and other people's experience through written word is so freaking cool. Mm-hmm. And so those will be mine for today. So that is a wrap. Do you have anything else you want to add or you feel good about it?
Just going to add one other quick thing. Going to throw a fourth one in because I'm also beyond appreciative of Corey on a daily basis.
Yeah.
He's someone who I can never spend too much time with. And just kind of what you were saying, just encouraging and compassion. Ever since we scheduled this today, he was like, I'm so excited for you to go to this podcast with her. Like, I know you love Claire and you're super excited to like tell your story and talk about things. And he hates hearing about my story. Obviously, he hates hearing about the shitty things I've been through in past relationships.
Sure.
And he hates hearing that I was taken to those such low points. But at the same time, he's so excited for me to share my story because I'm passionate about it and to have these conversations because, again, he knows I'm capable and he knows that I have these abilities to help other people and these passions to help other people. So I'm just so appreciative that even though he doesn't like to talk about or hear about my past stories, and I mean, no partner likes to hear about
how you were
their partners,
sure,
ex-partners, but
sure,
he is just so supportive, even though he doesn't like talking about it or hearing it. So
shout out. I love it. Okay. Awesome. All right. So all of the resources will be in the description. And so if you are still here, I have to say that, your time is valuable. So I really appreciate the fact that you've chosen to come spend it with us. And I hope that you've gotten something valuable out of it. And if you have, I hope that you would please subscribe to the show, rate and review it, and share it with somebody that you think that it will positively impact. And we just hope that you choose to have a beautiful day.